I'd like to propose a toast.
Hello and welcome to Before Brunch. I'm Megan Cassidy.
And I'm Cassie Delaney.
And we are your weekly celebrity pop culture, social issues and arts podcast. And we go live every Sunday morning right before brunch at about 11 a.m.
And we like to talk about all of the things that you're going to be talking about to your friends at brunch. So we take the things that have happened in the news, in the media, on the internet during the week, and we make sense of them for our lives and therefore your lives.
We are brought to you by Diet Coke in conjunction with their Because I Can campaign. So let us open a can of Coke and, as they would say on Love Island, crack on.
Ooh.
Lovely. Really good response to last week's episode. Makes me think we should do more book reviews.
Yeah, people loved it. I haven't had a chance to read Convenience Store Woman yet because
it's
been a hectic week. It's been mad. It's just been mental.
That was going to be my next question to you because I text you, was it on Wednesday, to check if you had opened it and you hadn't yet, but you haven't got a chance to.
I haven't got a chance to because you know what I've been doing this week?
What?
Studying for my motorbike theory test tomorrow morning.
Hashtag because I can.
Because I can. So I have that test tomorrow. So tune in next week to find out how I got on. I've done a few of the online versions and I have passed the majority of them.
Hmm.
It is difficult. And what I've learned is riding a motorbike seems to be very dangerous.
I would say it's one of the most dangerous things you could do statistically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been interesting. It's been a learning curve. I'm studying very hard, been reading up my driver theory book, having a great time. And I have that test at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So fingers crossed for me.
Is it comparable to the car driving test?
Well, it is. You have to do the car driving test again with the additional questions for the motorbike test, which I think is everyone's fear. That, like, you know, that feeling of once you get your driver's license, you're like, I never have to do this again.
Yeah.
They cannot take this away from me unless I do something really ridiculous. And you immediately forget all the stuff, right? But I did my theory test in 2008. And or before that, I did my driver's test in 2008. So I was past the threshold. If you go for another license and it's been 10 years, you have to do it again, which is terrifying. It's all different as well. There's loads more questions. There's loads more road signs and stuff.
Do you have to be able to drive a car in order to drive a motorcycle?
No, you have to get your, you have to do a specific combination theory test with the motorbike questions and the car questions.
So you technically have passed your car theory test in order to drive a motorbike.
Yeah, you have. Yeah. You do have to pass your car theory test.
Okay.
But then you can go and you get your provisional license, and then you go and you do this 2-day course. It's really expensive, but you go and you do it for 2 days, and then you can drive it.
Would you feel comfortable sharing with us what you have spent on your Vespa dream thus far? Do you know?
Oh, yeah, I know. I know. Okay, right.
What are we talking?
Basically, it's been free because, like we talked about before, put that old Vespa on a financial plan. So,
okay, not free.
Basically free because it's like it's €70 a month or something. It's a phone bill, basically. It's fine. Totally sustainable. Got my helmet on sale, €80. Paid €45 for this online test. Need to spend a few hundred on this course. Few more hundred on the insurance. But it's all going to be paid monthly.
I just don't think you're looking at this on a page. You have become quite financially responsible in the last maybe year.
Yeah, I have actually. Yeah. I have done very well. Yeah. I've saved money.
But you're not really... You're not deep diving into this, but that's okay. Maybe this is your little passion project on the side that you don't want to think about the cost.
This is one of those things where everything else now, like I have gotten very, very good. I'm making some long-term plans. I'm preparing for like my future. I have spreadsheets. I know where my money is going. This is the one thing where I was like, no,
Are these like weekly budget spreadsheets?
They're kind of more long-term budgets. It helps me to plan where my savings is going to be because I have a couple of big expenses coming up over the next couple of months that I need to know where the money sits. The best thing I ever did was that 7 days saving online saving account. in AIB because I cannot access my money. And I get this real whim when I get paid to like throw a load of money into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't access it for seven. Yeah. Like you can put it in for 7 days. You can access it after 7 days. But then you get to thinking like, oh, that's too late. It's going to be useless. I'm just going to have to live on this poverty for the next while anyway. And you you make do.
That sounds like it would work for me, and I think it's time for me to accept that that would work for me. And we've spoken a lot on the podcast, both in this series and in its original iteration, about habit forming and knowing your own personality before you can form a habit successfully. So you've now successfully formed the saving habit by knowing that you need to have zero access to your funds.
Exactly. I need to just not be able to touch it.
Yeah. Because you know yourself, and you're probably... So I was listening to Gretchen Rubin, who has a fantastic podcast this week. And she said there's four different types of personalities when it comes to these habits. There's an obliger who will do something because they're being held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
There are upholders who will uphold any promise they make to themselves or to someone else. So if you're an upholder and you decide you're saving €300 a week, you will do that. You don't need to put it into an account that you can't access because you've made the decision and you uphold it. Neither myself or yourself are upholders.
I would go as far to say as I've never even met an upholder.
Yeah. And
never.
Gretchen Rubin herself would opine that she is an upholder.
She's a liar.
I think it's quite smug for anyone to say that they're an upholder.
If anyone can say to me that they can put something away and have access to it and see it on the daily and it be there and not touch it, these are the people who will buy a bar of chocolate and eat one square and put it in the fridge.
Yes.
Losers, but people who don't people who don't exist. No, I'm going.
But they do exist. Like, you have to admit that they do. I feel like I don't know if I've met any upholder. No, I have met an upholder. I have an upholder in my head.
Is it someone we know?
Yeah, mutually? You know her too, but I'm not going to say who it is because an upholder, yeah, exactly, I feel tends to be quite would be perceived as maybe a little bit extreme.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I suppose you will have to have that, like, complete control.
It's an extreme personality trait.
Now, here's the trade-off, though. You're going to lose kind of your spontaneity.
Yes.
And your ability to go with the flow. And your ability
to
just...
excuses now?
Maybe. But I'm whatever the next personality type is coming. I don't feel I'm either one of those.
I don't think you are an obligator at all. I know what you are, but you'll have to tell me what you are.
Okay.
So the next two are, so we've had, an obliger who does things for other people, so they need external pressure. We have the upholder who can just, internal pressure is fine. Then you have the questioner who will do something if they believe that it's right. So if someone gives them a task or a deadline, they won't just automatically say, yes, I'll do that and feel good about doing it or completing the deadline. They will only feel good about doing it if they have kind of rolled around in bed with it and decided, yes, it's definitely the right thing for me.
Okay.
So their boss comes to them and says, can I get this report every Wednesday morning? They will struggle to comply with that unless they feel it's absolutely the
necessary.
Right thing to do.
Okay.
And then there's the rebel who struggles with any sort of external or internal pressure, in that even if they decide something themselves, their gut reaction is, well, why should I do it? So if they decided yesterday that they're going to hoover the floor every Tuesday night, they will fight themselves when it comes to Tuesday night. Likewise, if their personal trainer tells them that they have to go to a boxing class every Tuesday night, they will automatically say, no, I don't want to do that. I think I have you. Who do you think you are?
I would say I'm somewhere in between the questioner and the rebel.
I think you are a questioner.
Yeah. I'm probably more a questioner than a rebel. No, because once I decide on something, I have no problem committing to it as long as it's a good thing, as long as I feel it's necessary.
And that is very true of you, in that if you're not all into something, I would worry that maybe you wouldn't comply.
Absolutely not.
But you often, not surprise me, but your personality seems quite flaky.
Okay.
Like, it would.
Okay.
But you surprise me in that you don't fuck up things. If you care about something, you will be there every single time. Like, this podcast was a passion project. I worried about myself committing and I worried about you committing. Mm-hmm. And we both just totally pulled it out of the bag.
Yeah, we did. We did it really well. So what you're saying is, I'm like a croissant. I appear flaky, but I'm layered and delicious underneath it all.
If that's what you're taking from this, yeah. Like, that makes you feel good.
I'm going to choose to be positive about this
okay,
now.
Okay, you're a
and
croissant.
I will, you know, I'll take that with as a compliment.
Yeah.
I look like someone who has the potential to fuck up a lot of things, but doesn't.
But doesn't.
That's gorgeous.
That's what it is. But that's kind of a creative personality, I think, in general. I think I'm more of an obliger in that I enjoy just meeting external deadlines. I have absolutely zero willpower. But you see, the nice thing is, I'm sure other people would come to me and tell me that I do have good willpower, that, you know, from an outsider's perspective, I am an upholder, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
They think I am. But, you know, it's...
If you keep those external pressures quiet and mm-hmm. you don't let people know that they're there, then you do look like a highly motivated person who
That's
can deliver
it.
On deadline
yeah.
because of your own personal motivations.
Yeah. Anyway, it's fun. A motto that I've learned this week, and this is the last little piece of our preamble because it's been quite excessive. Here's what's changed my life this week.
Go for it. This should be a segment we introduce every week.
I think it should, because it often, like, there's often like one phrase or one sentence or one way of thinking that literally changes how I do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the one this week is, progress is better than perfection. So for me, my house is now nearly organized because of this mm-hmm. phrase, in that I would get so overwhelmed and intimidated by the thoughts of my spare room in the apartment, because I feel like if I want to start tackling that, it has to be perfect by the time I finish it.
Yeah.
So now every day I pick one little task that would be progression, and my goal is no longer perfection. My goal is just to progress. Just progress. Take the pressure off. Progress it in any tiny way that you can. If that means fold up the ironing board and put it up against the wardrobe, it's progression. So the progression in itself is an achievement. And I thrive on achieving or feeling like...
some level of satisfaction.
Yeah. And it's fucking working. I went home last night and I had done little bits of progression every day for maybe 2 weeks. So maybe that would be something tiny, like, tonight I will wash the tea towels, or tonight okay. I will clean the floor, or today my only task is to buy bathroom storage. And these tiny little things have all added up to where I went home last night and I said, I actually don't really have anything to do here.
Oh my God, beautiful.
Yeah. It works when it comes to work also.
Mm-hmm.
I very, very frequently will put off a task because I know that I can't complete it that day. But now on my to-do list, I will cross it off if I've progressed it, not if
okay,
I've completed
it. Okay, that is one of those things that I feel is going to benefit me greatly
yeah.
over the next couple of weeks. This week for me has been so overwhelming. Just, I've started... thinking about the next couple of months of my life and what I want and all of these things, a proper kind of like, what do I want to do? What does my day to day look like? What do I want my career to look like? What does all this, what is it going to be for me? And I just started like panicking and thinking like, oh my God, how do I know what I want? Do I want a dog? Do I want to work from home? Do I want to work here? Do I want to get an office? I was like looking at different hot desking options around Dublin, just totally panicking. But now mm-hmm. this week I'm going to approach it in that little steps
yeah.
of progress.
You are definitely in a phase of your life now that is... a bridging phase.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to a TED talk this week about personal financial crises. So people that literally have no money left, they didn't save for a pension and they're kind of in there. I'll have to look up who gave the talk. She was sensational and I'll put it in the show notes. But she said, you know, there's bridging work that we all need to do at times of transition. excuse me, in our lives. So when you retire, you go into a bridging phase. Mm-hmm. And in the bridging phase, you shouldn't know exactly what the outcome is going to be. You just need to accept that you are bridging, you are building a bridge, and you can't get to the other side until the bridge is built. So your bridging work, if you progress your bridging work a little bit every day, you will build the bridge. But there's different phases and different seasons to our lives.
You're getting very metaphorical here now, Megan. Very, like, I'm in a meadow right now, building this little fucking gorgeous curvy bridge and thinking about laying down in the bank in the sun, right? And
but
now
there you go.
Okay.
That's it. Visualize.
Visualize. Yeah. So I'm going to bridge from the summer into the new autumn. My life is going to look a little bit different. Yeah. I'm going to be working on different projects and exciting things, and okay, it's all going to be fine.
You
all
don't have totally to fine. Know what it's going to look like. Just progress it.
Okay.
Progression.
Very helpful.
Okay. So today, obviously, the big story of the week in celeb land has been Demi Lovato's hospitalization. Mm-hmm. We are in no way taking this lightly. It's not celebrity gossip, but true to the themes in this podcast, it is a gateway for us to talk about culture around mental health, addiction, and drug use. So I was really saddened when I saw the headlines, because Demi has always been very open about her issues with addiction. Yeah. And she's one of those celebrities that seems less removed than other celebrities, in that she'll stand on stage at a concert and she will talk about her. She has bipolar disorder. She talks about it. She talks very openly and honestly about how her behavior changes when she uses drugs. She names her poisons and names how they affect her behavior. And keeping sober for her is hard work. Mm-hmm. So this to me is not the, it's not an ending or a relapse. It's showing us that she is still having to work on this, and that maintaining sobriety is hard work forever.
The Diet Coke Because I Can campaign is about carefree fun with friends and celebrating the things in life that make you feel good. Take part in the Diet Coke Because I Can series by following hashtag Because I Can.
Yeah, and I think we've made an awful lot of progress in the conversations we have around addiction and alcoholism and understanding that they're an illness. But the difference that I think we need to realize that when we talk about addiction as an illness as opposed to any other illness is that it's always ongoing. And if you've ever kind of had experience with an addict or lived with an addict or, you know, just even known one, you'll know that for addicts, fighting addiction is a daily thing. Yes, it gets easier over time, but there are triggers and there are temptations and there are other issues that can impact someone's tendency or leniency towards taking the substances that they're addicted to. But I think what was particularly disheartening has been some of the conversation around this on Twitter. And I know that people, it's very easy, I suppose, to look at Demi Lovato and feel some sort of sympathy for her because, oh yeah, she lives in a very high pressure world. She's talked about bipolar disorder. She's talked about kind of her relationship with her birth father and how difficult that has been, and her relationship with her parents. She's talked about the interventions that her friends and her family had for her when she, 6-7 years ago, when she was really heavily using cocaine and drinking. And it is encouraging to see that level of sympathy towards her and that understanding and that empathy towards her life and her struggles. But the conversation that we still have around addiction here at home is still very detrimental, and it's still very difficult to hear, and there isn't that level of sympathy or understanding for it at all. And some of the conversation, even on Twitter, directed at Demi and other addicts, was kind of along the lines of addiction is a lifestyle choice. You know, you made that choice to go and purchase narcotics. You made that decision to go off and source it from somewhere, or, you know, you it was kind of just like people joking, being like, God, I wouldn't get half the sympathy if I went off and got a bag of heroin. Like, but for people like Demi and people who are addicts, it isn't a choice. It's a compulsion, you know, and it's I'm sure there's other factors in there. Like obviously she had started drinking, that kind of removes some of the inhibitions. She gets closer and closer to doing something that is a decision she doesn't want to make. But we all understand that. Like if you've ever drank or done anything or got too drunk, you would know that it gets to the point where you make bad decisions and things happen easier and you question them about it. But for someone like Demi or someone's an addict, all of those small little incidences lead up to this big, big, absolutely diabolical occurrence, which of course for her during this week was her overdose.
That's it. I mean, if we say that addiction is a choice, it's actually for me the opposite, in that if you are prone to addiction, sobriety is the lifestyle choice that you have to make. So you're actively choosing to be sober every day. And when Demi celebrated, she celebrated 6 years sober in March. And that, to me, those milestones and celebrations that you or I don't have to mark or say we've done 3 weeks sober or we've done.
Yeah.
It's constant work and it's 6 years of work. It's not 6 years without alcohol. It's 6 years of every day declining alcohol. Like you actively have to say no every day. It's never a case for someone like Demi or someone who struggles with addiction that they don't want it anymore. So therefore we can't really relate to what it feels like to battle that addiction, because we don't decline drink every day from a position of, we don't have to actively decline it. We have to actively seek it.
Yeah, but I think if you're, I mean, I don't know what Demi's lifestyle is, but I can imagine. But if you even to think for yourself, if you were someone who had an addiction, it would be very, very hard for you to live a normal life the way you do now and avoid all of those triggers or avoid all those temptations. Mm-hmm. I mean, you walk out of here now, out of this office, and you're, you know, in spitting distance of a couple of bars or pubs or whatever. When we usually record in our studio down in Pier Street, we walk out and we're right beside a pub. You walk up the road, you're going to pass loads of pubs. There's a culture here of every celebration is about drink. Every grievance is about drink. When you want to make up with someone, you go for a drink. Like your first date, it's usually a drink. Everything is centered around, especially in our culture, around substance.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol is our go-to thing. There is no celebration that we have or no event that we have that does not involve alcohol. And the more alcohol, the better. Or the more, the cheaper the alcohol, the better. Or fucking payday is a free bar, like.
I mean, that's it. Like, we leave our studio on Pier Street for an... We decide, we would have to decide to go into a pub.
Yeah.
An addict will have to decide not to. And that's coming from just a completely different starting point. And it's so true. I know, obviously, Demi is not Irish, but certainly when I try to abstain for a few weeks, the social pressure here is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's never a question of, are you going to have a drink? It's, why are you not drinking?
Why are you not drinking? Yeah.
And you have to have an excuse ready, and your excuse can't be, I just don't feel like it, or I don't want to. Because then, even if I were to say, I don't feel like it, or I don't want to, that's usually not the genuine reason. The reason would be, I'm trying to save money, or I'm trying to look after my health, because it's so ingrained in us that drink and substance is part of socializing, that there has to be a reason not to.
Yeah, I suppose I've never really attempted to quit drinking. Like I can go through periods where I've cut back, or like just decided that I'm going to stay in and save money or all that kind of stuff. And I generally will just choose not going near the place where the drink is going to be, because I know myself, if I'm going into a pub and all my pals are there and there's going to be drinks, and I'm going to want one. I do find that things like non-alcoholic beers and stuff are good. But when our culture is so, you know, we're taught from so young, I think, that being drunk and being tipsy is great crack. And aren't we brilliant crack? And don't you just stand around laughing and isn't it brilliant and sure, raise a glass and all that kind of jazz. And it's very hard to exclude yourself from that. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about last week. It's the shared experience. It's very hard to be the person who's in a group, in an environment that is geared up towards doing the drinking or the socializing and to not be involved in that experience.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, I wonder if I decided to quit drinking, would I be able to? And what would my life look like if I did that? Because I know myself that I would not be able to take myself into bars and wherever. I would not be able to socialize.
Yeah, you would have to avoid certain situations.
Yeah.
So we can imagine, I mean, there is a pattern of child stars turning or developing addiction.
Yeah.
So we can imagine that in Demi's social circle, she's not the only person who takes cocaine or drinks.
No.
She's doing it with other people. And unfortunately, she doesn't have the switch off point because it's not someone on her crew that ended up hospitalized. It's her. So she goes the whole way. It reminds me, in ways I had sort of, it felt positive this week because her experience is so different to what I remember in 2008 for Britney Spears.
Yeah.
In that when she was hospitalized, it was so shocking and so converse to everything that we had seen from Britney previously. Whereas Demi has had such a holistic journey to this point in that she has always been, while she was battling addiction, she was simultaneously working really hard and having great success. But it was always a part of her story for years. Her documentary, I think it's Simply Complicated. Simply Complicated. She opened up about her behaviors and about her addictions as alongside showing the nature of her day-to-day work and how she crafts her vocals and crafts her performances. It's always been a part of her act.
Yeah.
Britney had a very different experience in that she was, her image was crafted as, you know, the virgin who was going to be deflowered over a certain course of time.
She
and
was, yeah, she was the good Christian pop singer. It, you know, it was a different image that she had portrayed. That's why it was so shocking to see Britney Spears in that kind of environment. And also has never really been very public or acknowledged any difficulties she's had with addiction or substance abuse.
She has never really spoken out about any mental health issues, which she clearly has. I don't know if it, I know that I remember an article in Rolling Stone back, I think it was around that time. I was so affected by it. What age would I have been? Like 17 or something. I was so affected by it. And I remember in Rolling Stone, they said, you know, maybe there's a disease that fame creates that we haven't named yet. And at the time, I kind of blew that off. But that there could be something in that.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe there is something that's very abnormal. But the fame that we have now is very different to the fame that was around 100 years ago. It kind of started in, I think they, like people say, Princess Diana was the first person who was really pursued by paparazzi and experienced this new level of fame. And maybe it does alter something in your mind that there could be a mental health issue.
Yeah, I definitely think that there are certain pressures that being that exposed to a mass market does to a person. So there are pressures there that Demi had to be able to perform. She had to, she has such a, I mean, any sort of performer like that is going to have such a strict schedule. They need to be able to get up on stage. They need to have loads of energy. They need to have loads of confidence. They need to have their wits about them the whole time. They need to be able to brush off the shit that's being said about them. They need to be confident. And if you're someone who's not naturally like that, who has self-doubt or who has, you know, who is kind of a bit more withdrawn or who has not got the confidence or who is tired, who cannot keep up with the schedule. And someone comes to you and says, actually, here's a drug. It's going to give you loads of energy. It's going to make you feel fucking great about yourself. It's going to give you confidence. It's going to say that you can get up on stage. And then she tries that and takes that. And it's true. It, you know, it happens. I mean, I think, like, I'm not sure about whatever kind of cocktails of drugs she was on, but my limited understanding, and this all of this is just hashtag not scientific advice, but like my understanding of cocaine is that it does it's like it's a release of kind of what is it like endorphins and shit into your brain. Like it is a release of whatever the happiness
oxytocin.
Yeah, whatever the happy hormone is, it does release that into your brain. So when she has that, she is going to feel confident. It is going to be a chemical reaction that occurs in her inside of her and make her feel great. And it's one of those kind of drugs that isn't paraded as being too dangerous. Yes, in conjunction with a lot of alcohol and taken in extreme levels, it can be it's really, really, really bad. And it is terrible, and obviously it's highly, highly addictive. But if someone offers her that as a solution, she takes it and it works and she can access it, of course she's going to do it. And then she's obviously someone who's kind of predisposed to addiction, and that's just a recipe for absolute disaster.
Yeah. So I would say going, like, thank God it looks like she's okay and she's going to recover. And knowing Demi so far and how she's handled these things in the past herself, and Selena Gomez is another example of someone who's been very open about mental health issues and not substance abuse. But Demi will make this a part of her conversation and a part of her journey. And this is not the end of 6 years sober and we're starting again.
Yeah.
This is part of maintaining sobriety for someone who has an addictive personality. And she will probably be very vocal about it. And it's something that 10 years ago when this happened to Britney Spears, people weren't talking about, which harks back to the HSE's recent campaign.
Hashtag do you use cocaine? Yeah, I think that, like, we've obviously, Ireland has come under so much scrutiny over the last couple of years for our treatment of addiction. Because it is very much right now treatment centres, plaster on the problem kind of approach, you know, methadone, whatever. It's detox. It's not doing anything to alleviate the problem. If anything we've learned from Demi and other people's kind of relapses and experiences, and the sheer fact that this is not the first time we've heard about someone relapsing and they'll relapse again and they'll go back to treatment and they'll relapse again. The treatment and the detox and, you know, the abstaining isn't a solution. There was a study, and it's actually been featured in Indie 100 here, talking about Demi, about how the majority of drug users and addicts have an underlying mental health problem. So I think we can safely say that the majority of people who are really struggling with substance abuse have motive. They have something in their psyche, whether it's a psychological mental health kind of struggle, or whether they have had, there's been a lot of cases of people who've been abused taking to drugs. There is generally something there with them. And I think that our drug treatments at the moment don't do enough to rectify that problem.
I think the conversation is so important. And I know that the campaign got a lot of backlash about normalizing cocaine use. But when I read the advice they give, it seems to me like a really pragmatic way to go about tackling an issue that is prevalent right now.
I completely disagree.
Do you?
I think the whole campaign is totally, totally irresponsible. I think that I read the two fact sheets and I actually thought they were a joke. Like, first of all, the imagery that's used on the front of the posters. If you are walking around town or in publications or online and you see this image that is a bag of cocaine and you're an addict, that's a trigger. Like, that's not educating people. Everyone knows what cocaine looks like. You don't need to see it in a poster in this big, what looks to be like a fucking 10 gram bag of cocaine. Like, with the words, do you use cocaine, written out in it. I think visually it's so irresponsible. The fact sheet itself does nothing to warn people about the effects or the long-term effects of drug use at all. Never mind cocaine or crack, the two that they kind of focused on. It doesn't do anything to educate people about long-term use. And I think what it does is, for younger people, it removes the barrier to entry because it doesn't make it seem like it's that dangerous. It gives advice like making sure you source your cocaine, take a tester with your friends 2 hours before you decide to use the drug, you know, and it's making it seem like if you plan it, it will all be fine, which isn't the case. And it's so, so irresponsible. This isn't a hair dye patch test. You can't take a small snippet of cocaine and come back 2 hours later and decide, oh, that's grand, I had a great reaction, I'm going to use loads of it now again. It just doesn't work like that. And I think the way that they've gone about it and launched it and normalized it is such a problem.
But do you think maybe the execution is bad, but that the conversation should be had?
No, I don't. I think that we should be doing more to educate people around
the dangers.
The dangers. And there was a great piece by Brian Boyd in the Irish Times this week about not only the dangers, but like the source of cocaine and the source of drugs in this country, and how it's funny because the people, you know, cocaine was always seen as like the Celtic tiger drug, and now we're back up to the same levels as we were in 2007, and actually we're the fourth highest users of cocaine in Europe.
Mm.
I think it was like 3 in 10 people had said that they had used it. Like, and it's clearly an expensive drug. Mm. And it's the people who want to be seen as socialites and elitists who are using it. And yet they're the very people who are supposedly very concerned about like environmental issues and are supposed to be socially conscious now. And if you understand where your cocaine is coming from, there's going to be a trail of slavery, deaths, abuse there to get the cocaine into your pocket in fucking whatever nightclub you decide to be in doing it. Like,
but then this campaign is obviously a reaction to this explosion of cocaine back on the scene, and a reaction to the death. I think the death toll has more than doubled from 2010 to 2015. I think since then it's doubled. So it's still quite a small number in Ireland, but it has doubled. So this campaign is a reaction to that. All along, we've warned people and educated people about the dangers of cocaine, and it hasn't worked.
I do agree with Brian Boyd that we need to stop focusing so much on maybe just the dangers and talk about the long-term effect drug use has on your mental health.
Mm.
Talk about the downs. Like in that fact sheet, it was like, oh, your downs after will be, you know, you'll feel sad, basically, was the effect of it. But, like, go talk to the people who are seeking treatment for cocaine addiction who are in the depths of despair.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that simple. It's not like, oh, you're going to feel sad afterwards. Like, I've known people and seen people who have suffered, like, nervous breakdowns after drug use. And this isn't me fear-mongering people, but this is the reality of it, is that it has an impact on your mental health. It has an impact on your ability to do work. It has an impact on how you feel about yourself. And I just don't think that we fully understand the long-term effects enough now to say that there's correlation between or causation between drug use when you're younger and mental health difficulties in your 40s, 50s or whatever. You know, and like, I'm not preaching. I'm not saying that don't go out and have fun or do whatever it is that you want to do. I'm not saying don't do it. But I just think that this campaign on a wider level is irresponsible.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, those are interesting points. I didn't think about the image and how triggering it would be for an addict. For me, I felt speaking about it, the fact that it's become so much more popular now to open the conversation so that people don't get it from sources that they don't trust and that they feel more comfortable to speak about it or ask where they should get it from, or, you know, obviously, when things are unregulated, they're more dangerous. But I do completely agree that it did sort of glamorize it a little bit or make it seem like it's okay to do it.
I think, it just became too normal. And I think if that's going to be our approach, if our approach is going to accept that people do drugs and people like to take Class A drugs and people like to feel good in it, well, then fucking regulate it. Then legalize it, regulate it, bring it in and be able to control it and teach people about the impacts on it, whatever. I think that, you know, I think that's the only way to do it. You can't give people a fact sheet and expect them to safely take drugs that they're going to buy in the streets.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't work like that. You're giving people facts about something that's inconsistent. You know, it's not just like, oh, here, go and take this cocaine. They're not getting pure cocaine. They're getting cocaine, rat poison, whatever it is, all mixed in together. And to be able to, or to, for the advice to be, just make sure it's grinded up properly so you don't have big lumps of it.
Yeah.
That to me is just, they've missed a huge trick here. Like,
yeah. I mean, there is an opportunity here, but this probably just wasn't executed as best as it could have been.
This was not executed well. This to me is like if Father Ted and Dougal got together and decided that they were going to talk to the people about the drugs.
With this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. That's us for this week. If you have any thoughts or comments on anything that we've chatted about today, you can find us at Love in Dublin or at lovein.ie or at Cassie Lorraine or at Megan M. Cassidy on Twitter and Instagram. And we will see you back here, same time, same place next week. So thanks for listening. Bye. Bye.
The Diet Coke Because I Can campaign is about carefree fun with friends and celebrating the things in life that make you feel good. Take part in the Diet Coke Because I Can series by following hashtag Because I Can.